Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I'm Tom Kostura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. Let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 23rd, 2026. All right, Tom, what are you going to kick off?
First one for this week, I have an article from Group IB. It's titled Operation Olalampo. Inside Muddy Waters' Latest Campaign. So this one's a bit of a meaty article. There's a lot of stuff here, but I'm going to try to get through it as seamless as possible, Scott. But please fill in any gaps that I missed, because there's quite a bit of material in this one. This article talks about an Iran-linked espionage resurgence. So Muddy Water launched Operation Olalampo, targeting multiple organizations and individuals, primarily in the MENA region, or the Middle East North Africa region, beginning around the back end of January of this year. So the campaign introduced several new malware variants, including a Rust backdoor dubbed Char, downloaders, Ghost Fetch, and HTTP VIP, and an advanced backdoor dubbed Ghost Backdoor, while also continuing their traditional tradecraft. So Muddy Water leveraged both Telegram bots and traditional custom C2 servers, kind of giving a bit of a rare look into different executed commands and tools being used. And they had a kind of bit of a blended delivery and exploitation. So spear phishing with malicious office macros was the primary goal, but evidence is showing that there was opportunistic exploitation of public facing vulnerabilities that were also attempted. They also shows that it was their shared infrastructure overlaps with late 2025 operations. So kind of just showing more of that continuity in their playbook and the diversification of the specific group. So a lot of the technical details, there's a ton here, but there's some interesting stuff. So I'm going to try to run through it. The Microsoft Office document that was attached to one of the phishing variants, typically it was either an Excel or a Word document, and it would carry a malicious macro that would trigger on the workbook open. And it had evade sandbox hooks by using nested wait loops. So the macros decode and drop distinct payloads to file system paths like your public downloads, users' public downloads directory. That was the char, which was dubbed a Nova service.exe. There was also a Microsoft Excel user.exe, which was that Ghost Fetch downloader. And then the Microsoft Word user.exe, which was that HTTP VIP downloader. So the basic progression from downloader to backdoor, Ghost Fetch acts as a first stage loader that reflectively loads the second stage, which is the Ghost Backdoor. So the Ghost Backdoor, a couple things that of note that were in this, there was a few kind of unique or interesting anti-alias or anti-analysis. Man, I'm going to get through talking today, I promise, where it actually tracked and looked at the hardware to see if it had less than 2 gigs of RAM, less than 2 cores for CPU, and fewer than 2 previously connected USB devices. If it detected that, it would immediately terminate. It also would look to make sure that there was user activity, so validating mouse movements and screen resolution checks. And it also scanned for debuggers, virtual machine artifacts, and AV software, just to name kind of a couple things. Some of the persistence inside of this, it would copy itself to Microsoft Windows Burn Util, and it would modify registry to maintain persistence. Seems like typical kind of the user shell folders and startup paths. So just a couple things to note there. So the HTTP VIP loader, this one was interesting because it would perform a specific check on a hard-coded domain. And if the infected machine belonged to that domain, the malware would terminate. Why this domain was interesting is when they did some investigating on it, they found that it was part of a honeypot. And the malware was, you know, the actor was smart enough to include it inside of their malware, which was interesting. Also kind of interesting that it was limited to that, just that one domain, but I digress. And then another part of the HTTP VIP piece, they would actually pull down a legitimate version of AnyDesk remote management tool. So something of note there. Moving on to the other piece of malware. So Char, which is the Rust-based backdoor, communicates via Telegram bot C2 and supports interactive commands, including CMD and PowerShell execution. So one of the kind of interesting pieces here is, one, it gave user insight to some of the commands that were able to be run. It also has the ability to leverage various strings containing like emojis and other kind of like standout pieces that indicate that this was more of an AI trained tool, or they used an AI model to kind of generate the code in this tool. So that was something that I thought stood out for that one specifically. And then lastly, the Ghost backdoor. This was the advanced backdoor that's dropped by GhostFetch. It really kind of adapts its installation based on the environment it's in. So it installs as a service under or named Microsoft Version Updater. And then from there, it will set up encrypted communications and uses French named IP endpoints, which was interesting. And then it has a pretty granular command structure to really like attempt to evade detection. So basic stuff, file operations, you know, your read writes, your process creations, and start an interactive shell, download PE and map it to memory. So some pretty basic stuff. It also had some timer variants in it to kind of like help it avoid detection or delay alerting. Let's keep going. There's so much in here, Scott. So if I'm jumping around, I'm hoping you'll catch me here. But yeah, this was interesting because I thought there were some standout things in each of the given tools. I thought there was a couple unique points, something that was relatively novel to typical things we talk about. There's, I think, quite a bit to consider potentially hunting for in this, but I'm going to take a breather and just let you jump in for a minute. All right, Scott.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, they provide more of the, some unique things in their breakout of what the capabilities are. But if you just look at some of the MITRE technique mentions as far as like what the malware does, you still see registry run keys. So they don't talk about that necessarily in like the big description of everything. But that being mentioned, and in most cases is probably the generic one. There are unique ones, and I would assume they would call those out if they were using a unique area to try to do a run key persistence. So that's something to kind of pay attention to. And then obviously the startup folders, which I think you mentioned as well, because they kind of talk about it a little bit, was kind of a big thing. And then, you know, there's some of the tools, like we've talked about this before. When you talk about script interpreters like Command Prompt or PowerShell, it's really good to understand what is executing those things in your environment. And what I mean by what, like what are their traditional parent processes? Because understanding how people generically use computers, from like your admin style user to like your non-tech computer user, there's some key behaviors that, you know, could stand out for what you would expect to see and what traditionally would just completely stand out. There's some abilities to identify some of those. And they did mention early on, there's a lot of use of macros. And I just think it's interesting because, you know, what Microsoft in the latest security release, like when I say latest, within the past couple of years, right, I think it is, they supposedly disabled macros by default versus, you know, making it on the admin or users to disable the macros. So I'm always interested in, we've kind of been seeing lately in a lot of our like research just for the podcast alone, where macros are being leveraged more and more often. And it's got to just make you wonder, like, what is it that's causing that? Is it pre-configured to have them enabled? Is it required because the business, you know, heavily leverages macros in some way? And when I think about that, like, let's say there's a business case for something that you know is just rampantly used by threat actors, and you can't avoid just putting in the protections up front to force the threat actors to do different things. That's when it's really good to have real-time detections, right? When you can build detections on, okay, well, when a macro is executed, for instance, or, you know, things like that, what are some follow-on things that we should pay attention to? And I'm pretty certain there are some registry writes that happen in accordance with some macros being executed. If I'm calling off of memory, could be partially wrong there, but I think there's something like that. So there's different triggers you can do to know macros are enabled, or not necessarily enabled, but also being executed. So those are worth real-time detections if something you can't put protections or controls around. And the other thing too, and I've seen this before, and I don't know if it was a previous Muddy Water report or not, but you know, a lot of people get, you know, curious using like Shodan and services like that, and you're always wondering, well, those services were really good for attackers, how can defenders theoretically use them? And that to move payloads in the like easiest way possible, a lot of red teamers, threat actors, will stand up those Python simple HTTP servers, which is basically allows you to have a web server that you can go to that you can download files from. And then, you know, on the back end, you can upload files too. So it kind of looks like just like a basic FTP directory, but it's not FTP, it's HTTP. And that's where you have a good use case for, hey, let's scan IP spaces or just use Shodan in general to find these things, and then look at geolocation for some of those things. Because sometimes geolocation also helps you potentially find what these could be associated with. Because, you know, the reason why this is leveraged is because attackers are lazy. But that's what they saw here, where they saw there was an open directory, because there's usually no auth associated with these. And they can see tool sets. And these are huge wins, because sometimes there's stuff that the adversaries are testing for future things. So there's kind of just sitting there so they can kind of play. It has the current tools they potentially will be using. So you can potentially even do hash-based matching if you wanted to, but also look at capabilities and tool sets they're using, and potentially have other detections and hunts that could be leveraged there. So there's ways to kind of get ahead of some of the, like the power curve, when you have time to look for that. But yeah, like it's some of the traditional things that we've talked about. They also do, it looks like, the geolocation lookup stuff. So call outs to those geolocation type sites is good to know what those, like what adversaries are using. Ransomware actors use it as well, but in this case, they're using the ipinfo.io. And so that's commonly not leveraged by a lot of users or normal applications in your environment. So that's good to pay attention to when you, if you have that kind of telemetry, to look for just those generic lookups. And sometimes, depending on the telemetry, like you have good EDRs or even Sysmon in some instances, can help you identify what process is actually doing that call as well. If you're looking on the endpoint versus you have some sort of proxy log data, that could be hugely beneficial to help you even rule certain things out. And then, you know, they even talk about some of the workflow. They have like a whole section as far as the original command history, showing some of the workflow towards the bottom of this, that has a ton of things dealing with the Telegram bot analysis, or before the Telegram bot analysis, that has, you know, all the basically the Python for the server looking. Oh, I mean, I guess all these things are on the server, right? The history, basically. So you can see the setup of like the status of Apache, looking at the firewall ads that were there. So they were able to kind of learn about what was being kind of set up to basically set up that easy HTTP Python server, so to speak. So it's just really good kind of random details all thrown together. There's a lot kind of here, but like it's all like in different pieces the way they broke it out. It's not my favorite thing, because it's not like, you know, start to finish storytelling. But there's a lot of things that as you kind of study this, I think it's, you can pull out a lot of good technical things that are worth looking at, and they also are technical things that overlap with other types of attacks.
Yep, totally agreed. There's a ton here, and that's a lot of the encoded commands and observed command execution down the path too is really interesting. We see a lot of common things that we do talk about. So this is back to that whole landscape of, you know, there are really core behaviors that tend to pop up constantly. So one of the ones that you're seeing when they're demonstrating and reversing the obfuscation of a lot of the PowerShell commands is you're seeing those common techniques to pull payloads down from the internet through PowerShell, running, you know, in a hidden window, bypassing execution policies, all the basic stuff that we talk about routinely. So just something else to note, that's low hanging fruit, but it's always appearing. But yeah, a lot here. I did like the breakdown of the command history. I thought that was kind of interesting to see. We don't typically see something like that, which was a cool ad, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it attributes basically like there's a human behind this, right?
Right.
Yep. Even though there's malware deployed, the malware is just a tool in a lot of cases. Sometimes when people think about viruses, they think it's just like this run on its own entity that's not even associated with people, but it really is just another tool. It's like any other program in a lot of cases. So, yeah.
Yeah, they also seen, I did leave this one out just before we move on, but they did also show kind of a command history, you know, listed of executed commands, and there's a ton of discovery commands in there, like you see sequential discovery commands, right?
Yeah.
Running a net group to an IP config, pings, NSLookups, whoamis, all of that kind of sequentially running. That's a pretty good indicator of somebody's profiling you for something.
Yeah, and what's nice is they're using the same arguments, right? Mm-hmm. Like the ping, like they have the ping dash in to dash A, right? So like, you know, it's doing ping, but it's doing two pings. Like those are really good fingerprinting for behavior, as well as help you kind of look for things outside of what's normal in your environment. Because a lot of times, for instance, in a Windows environment, people very seldom set number of counts for ping because they just let it run its four pings by default because there's no reason to run, you know, to terminate it. But in this case, sometimes threat actors like to set a specific value for different reasons. And that stands out from your traditional user, right?
Yep. All right, Scott, what's next for today?
Let's jump to, let's see if I can find the terrifying article. Yeah. So, this is from, The Record, right? Recorded Future News. And I think articles like this are always interesting, but it's really hard to frame them as like, what does it really mean? And you'll understand what I'm trying to say as I dig into this. But basically, researchers, this title of the article, researchers warn Volt Typhoon still embedded in U.S. utilities and some breaches may never be found. It basically is going through a whole review and it has some of the tie-ins from some of the stuff Dragos, which is a really good firm that deals with critical infrastructure and those types of like operational technology environments that critical infrastructure utilizes. Hey, you know, Rob Lee, their CEO, right? He chimes in and basically makes that claim. And it's always interesting because then, you know, people start to like really freak out. But it really comes down to, and we've worked in, you know, critical infrastructure industry before, not every piece of our critical infrastructure has the same budget, to deal with the same set of problems or whatever it is, right? You can have a small utility even in a space that's just not going to have the same resources. And I think that's what this is kind of attributed to. And, you know, we talk about compliance comes up a lot in these conversations as well. You know, we should have these regulations and these, you know, what companies have to do if they're in this space. And it's true that helps, but compliance can't force people necessarily to do the best of the best, right? It's like you got to have a way to say you're checking the box the best you can, because the goal isn't to put you out of business just so you can stay compliant. Otherwise, compliance would be kind of have a negative impact versus trying to have some of the positives. And with these type of environments, it really comes really down to visibility more than anything else, because especially if someone makes the claim, like there'll be undetected, or they may never be found. It's not so much that like they're just so invisible, you know, per se, because if something never really did any activity at all, and had no way to communicate, would it be any value to an adversary? Probably not, right? So it comes back to like, these environments sometimes is really tough to get visibility into, depending on what technologies you have. And some of the security, like we've made a lot of strides for like convenience and reliability to be able to manage these types of environments that aren't 100% isolated like they used to be, which just kind of opened up some potential weaknesses or avenues for if something gets in, then it basically has a way to get in and communicate out in some regard. And there, you know, the big thing was, it was, you know, pre-positioning. That's kind of what the goal was in a lot of this. And it's about collecting a lot of telemetry information so that if there was going to be a type of attack, that attack would have a lot more success or impact. You know, sometimes even attacking a small entity can impact a larger entity, depending on the industry and what that is from a critical infrastructure perspective. And, you know, sometimes like this type of embedding might not be where the attack really originates either, right? You know, if they are able to learn about a vulnerability or a weakness in design and things like that, then it might help them develop an attack that will come in from a whole nother area. So just looking at this is where the attack is going to originate would almost kind of turn on artificial blinders, potentially, I would think. So, you know, this is why it's really important when you think about, like, from a threat hunting perspective, you know, what are your crown jewels? Everyone always talks about this in security, right? And it's really hard to put that into like, well, that's good for me to know how my business makes money or what's most important to my business. But like understanding, okay, well, how can those areas be affected? Like, what are the avenues of approach look like? Like, if someone needed to reach and touch this thing on a physical wire, or, you know, through an airwave, is that possible? Where do they have to be for that to happen? You know, what kind of things are between this and that? What telemetry is around that I could potentially either tighten down or, you know, regulate differently? So it, in a lot of ways, this comes to like a design thing for security first, and then also looking at telemetry for security second. And if you don't have a huge budget, and we've talked about this before, knowing what you have and what you're defending is almost the most important thing when you don't have a budget, because you can make better decisions when you get any kind of budget, right? Because if you don't really know what you're protecting outright, and you do finally get some budget, or you can make the justification for some things, man, you better hope you get the best value gain for what your decisions are when you're running things that tight. So I think there's some like lessons or things to think about that this starts up. And the other thing that they mentioned in this article too, which kind of, we've talked about nation states and how they can operate, but Drago specifically calls this out, in their research. They've kind of highlighted there's actually another group that kind of has been associated, working with Volt Typhoon. Essentially, they've dubbed them Sylvanite, and they specialize in initial access. Basically, how can they break into places and then hand things off to Volt Typhoon? And, you know, when you think of dedicated roles and responsibilities, especially when it comes from like cyber attack, it sometimes can make groups way more effective, because there's a lot of like kind of research or testing and other things that go into some of these attacks. Same thing we do in defense. And if you can just prioritize on one thing, you can spend a lot more time and get a lot more success on those different pieces, and then figure out how to stitch those together versus trying to boil the ocean. Like, you know, if you were dropping into a network and say, hey, secure this network, and you're thinking, well, I've got to figure out how to get all these tools up and running, get all this data flowing to certain places, figure out how to detect and then process this to respond, that's big. But if you only were responsible for one thing out of that list, you probably do a much better job. Kind of the same thing. So nation states function the same way, right? You know, they have enough resources, they have enough people, and they sometimes have highly specialized roles, so that they can keep their mission set supported effectively. Because there's nothing worse that, you know, if you have a group that gets in on their own, right, and then they get kicked out, well, now they got to figure out how to get back in, and it slows down whatever their mission set is initially. Well, if you have a group that specializes in that and they get kicked out, they can just basically ping, hey, we got kicked out. Can you get us in another way based on what you've been successful with elsewhere, right? Just kind of think of it in that way. So kind of like a scare piece, which I don't really like, but it really comes down to like, what are the important things? And it doesn't mean I don't think we can't find them. It's just we don't have the resources, the architecture and things in place currently everywhere. And it just shows what kind of gap that creates when we don't really build things with security first, or we change how we use technology and what that introduces when it comes to risk and potential problems. So yeah, big thought piece. I wouldn't take it too like over the top. I would take it serious, but understand really what it's saying and what it means and how it, I guess, changes how you think about problems and maybe influences decisions you make to try not to be in a similar situation. So yeah, I know I kind of went on there for a little bit, but yeah, Tom, what was your take?
No, I mean, I get it, man. Well, honestly, this topic could probably be an entire show by itself, right? Mm-hmm. Especially considering some of the things that we've experienced in our past. But I like that it's a scare piece personally, for a reason. I think some of the stuff in this area just generally isn't discussed enough. Yeah. And I don't think it's necessarily something that's like, oh, their sky is falling, all of that, right? Because there are so many variables that come into things when you start talking about critical infrastructure, right? The way that environments are set up, the different types of tooling that are used. You talked about the variety of different things that are in a given space. Like very rarely is any one given utility or infrastructure piece set up in a similar way as another. They're all very unique and very complex in a lot of ways, for various reasons. With this though, when I see this, what it makes me want to do is just continue to have that conversation. If I'm part of critical infrastructure, I want to make sure that the reality and the risk stuff is continuously talked about. We know from other incidents, other intelligence or other reports or other, you know, events that have occurred, how certain nation states tend to work, especially the ones that'll lie in wait and then leverage you when they need to. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know, what, like they talk about Odvul Typhoon, you know, we know some things about how the Chinese nation state groups tend to act, as one example. And the lie in wait stuff is important. And I think that considering the avenue that the groups that are talked about here tend to go after, right? They generally will target, honestly, it seems like low hanging fruit when it comes to vulnerabilities and public accessible devices that hold those vulnerabilities, right? It's, you can't freak out knowing that you might be compromised, but this is where I think it really kind of throws that dart into that piece on the whiteboard of know your environment, right?
Yeah.
So you don't need to freak out about this article, though I do like that it brings enough, hey, this could be a problem, because in reality it could be. And not necessarily is, but you need to consider it. And I think that like things like this, from my mind, they drive me to knowing my environment more. So I can understand the nuances. I can understand the things that are there. And we also know, like, I think this goes for pretty much all environments. Patch management gets complex. And the more environments that you have stitched together, the more complex it gets. And the more critical items you have in your environment that require uptime, require response time, you know, can't necessarily go down or even risk going down, can significantly impact how you manage your patching. So there's a lot to consider here. I'd love this article, man, but it rings near and dear to my heart, because I think conversations like this should always be had, not with a sky is falling approach, but more of we should take these threats seriously and we should consider them with real decision-making prowess, right? Real ways to assess ourselves, know our environment, make sure that we're positioned, even if you are, you know, unfortunately someone that has a compromise that's just lying and waiting. you know, find ways to consider how to dig those things out, how to hunt for stuff in those ways, and just really just have those conversations internally. I love pieces like this. I think reactionary, though, like to your point, like, you know, kind of the scare tactic, I think it tends to spawn people in certain decision-making places to freak out a little bit. But for me, down the lines, I'm like, hey, you know, we need to talk about this. So please, you know, flash it, make it scary so somebody opens their ears and listens.
Well, you know, there's two other points that I was kind of thinking of as you were talking. One, how important architecture is, right? But what I want to tangent from that is, you know, we were at a point where most cloud didn't exist. We had architectures we were stuck with, and no one was going to rebuild their entire architecture, right? They were going to try to figure out how to make it work and make adjustments as best, but they're not going to like start fresh. Then we started moving a lot of things to the cloud. And then you've even seen over the past couple of years, there's some industries or some big companies, they decided that the cloud's not as cost effective as they thought. And they're moving things kind of more back to on-prem. That the one cool thing about kind of being able to go to the cloud and then making those decisions to come back, it gives you kind of a potential window to think about architecture a little better, to kind of rebuild if you do come back, right? And the cloud also, if you ever wanted to rebuild your architecture, the cloud is also a great way to say, I'm going to do that. I don't have to do it in production. I can move production to cloud for however many years for this big project and then re-architect and bring it back down. I don't know what the costs are for moving back and forth. I know moving data can be costly depending on what your, you know, business is. But, you know, there's things like that that may be interesting to think about. But the other thing is, you know, when we started in security, you know, and we kind of still hear it, but not as much as we used to, where they're like, well, you practice security as if you've already been breached, or you assume you've been breached, right? And with all the latest and greatest technologies that are coming out from like the defense, cyber defense spaces, and with AI and things like that, people have kind of moved away. Like, I don't think senior executives feel comfortable with that statement anymore. For a while, they accepted it too. They're like, well, there's a good chance that we're breached and we haven't found it yet, but it's not impacting us. And they're like, yeah, no, that makes sense. I know this is challenging. Now it's like, if we were to like, we got a phishing attack and they got executed, they're like, what? Like, how do we let this happen? Like, this is big. We shouldn't, you know, this shouldn't be happening. And you're like, I mean, sure, right? But like, if you're on the assumption that we're already breached, these things are going to happen and we need to know how to handle them and have processes in place. This article kind of speaks to that. Like, hey, like that whole mantra, you know, secure as if you've already been compromised, exists. It's kind of why zero trust kind of became a thing or more of a thing again. But yeah, I feel like that kind of, we shouldn't let that idea or ideology die with upper management. They should still be speaking that same thing as well. Like, well, that's how we do security. We don't think that we're not breached. We just haven't been impacted by a breach, you know?
100%. I think that needs to be the case, at least for the practitioners at a minimum, right? So the people down there kind of digging in, just know that that's almost a certainty, or assume it's almost a certainty. And it's going to, I think it has you operate with, you know, more of a bit of a hair trigger or the ability to sense something faster.
Plus, you don't think it personal. It's not your fault you're breached. You're already breached. It's just your job to find it and clean up, right? It's like a mindset.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily move with fear, right? So you can look and dig the stuff out, and you can get in there and you can understand and try to search things. And you can understand that some of the stuff, if you're talking nation state, is probably hidden in a way that's really complex. That's probably sitting there in a way that's really, exactly. So that drives you more to kind of dig in, dig through logs you might not necessarily understand, and just like, just makes you better for your environment. So yeah, that mentality, I think, is a great one to have and hold.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, all right, on to more scary things. What do you have?
So I have my second one for this week is an article from Lab 52. It's titled Operation Macro Maze. New APT 28 campaign using basic tooling and legit infrastructure. So a state-aligned espionage campaign, APT 28,
ran Operation Macromaze between at least September 2025 and January 2026, targeting specific entities in Western and Central Europe. Rather than like custom malware, the campaign used basic tooling. So we're talking, again, macros, another appearance of macros, VBS and batch scripts, HTM and HTML, combined with legitimate services to really drive that blend into normal activity. They use legitimate infrastructure as well. So public webhook services were highly leveraged for both tracking and exfil, really in an attempt to reduce that anomalous C2 signal and complicate network detection. So some of the kind of technical behavior chain that we're seeing in this one. So through spear phishing, malicious Word documents with macros disguised as credible lures. So we're talking like, you know, fake government documents, agendas, things like that, are sent via email. And each document includes a include picture XML field referencing a remote webhook site or a webhook site image. Opening that document triggers an HTTP request that confirms execution to the adversary. So the macro acts as a dropper that writes roughly six artifacts. So we're looking at those VBS files, batch files, command scripts, and HTML and HTML templates, and they drop them in the user profile using like a GUID style file names. The macro invokes a VBS script that executes a command, a CMD file, proceeding to install the next stages. So some of the persistence piece here, the CMD constructs a Windows scheduled task XML at runtime and registers it with scheduled tasks and scheduling a periodic execution of the payload script. So the tasks kind of vary from 20 to 61 minute intervals based on the variant in play. The batch scripts clean up artifacts and then use Microsoft Edge to render Base64 encoded HTML that interacts with the webhook URLs to then download fragments for building on intermediate CMD and exfiltrate collected output. The final HTML files include auto-submitting forms that post the captured data to those webhook endpoints when rendered by Edge. Edge was used in headless mode as well in this, which I think is definitely worth noting, as well as used in a way that it hid the window off screen. So something worth noting there. Some of the other pieces of the tradecraft here I thought were worth pointing out. So the macro evolution includes that fake Word error message and simulated send keys. So down, enter, up to kind of bypass enable content prompts. There's heavy string concatenation in the macros. So basically things like they would split like wscript.shell into multiple substrings. So, you know, think like the first part of wscript, WSCRI, and then the second part would be pt.shell, just in ways to use this to rebuild later to help that initial deploy evade detection. And then the use of the public webhook services for beaconing and exfil really does play into hiding, you know, kind of inside of what would likely be legitimate developer API flows. So something to consider there. But yeah, this one, not overwhelmingly novel, but this is another, you know, we're talking APT. We're talking using common tooling on inside of the, you know, inside of the environment, common approaches, things we, like you mentioned with the macros that a lot of people, I think, put out of mind after some of the announcements from, you know, Microsoft, but obviously it's still being used by some of the better groups that we know of. And then, you know, I thought some of the stuff here does still trick some of the basic behavior things we talk about, you know, with VBS launching CMD, you know, kind of the process chain that you see. There's, you know, there's other little pieces inside of this that are common things that we talk about, the use of the, you know, WScript and the ways that it's being leveraged, but nothing crazy here. But I still like, it's just worth talking about, right, Scott? Like constantly we have, you know, the APT stuff is hot in mind this week, it seems. And it's just, hey, these are basics. These are things that are common, and they're just figuring out creative ways to combine them together, as always, to a pretty high effectiveness. But what'd you think on this one?
No, I like how you can kind of see like the, I don't know if it's a maturation of why they went to the different variants or if it was just kind of like their process. But I was curious, you know, when they send that webhook, right, from the document to basically verify that someone opened the document, that was kind of like what they were alluding to, was that's what, why do that little picture fetch, you know, the XML, that webhook.site embedded in the XML. There's like a GUID there, right, associated with it. And I wonder if that GUID changes based on whatever document they're sending so they can track who is the recipient as well. Because like that's a lot. I mean, from like a, you know, if they walk through different variants of whatever it is they're going through, that could be informative where like, oh, they see where someone opened the document and they didn't have any of the follow on stuff. Well, that would mean that some security thing stopped something and then they do another variant to bypass what they think stopped that. And then it's successful. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder if that was a driver for why there were so many variants, because they could validate, no, they did get it and they did open it. It just failed. So let's rehash how we got to be successful. Doesn't call it out here. That's just an assumption for me, but it would be a kind of a cool way to manage your attack, to deal with like, you know, changing defenses or if you've gotten discovered, that kind of stuff. So, you know, that part I thought was kind of an interesting data piece. The other things, you know, when you see like they break up the command for WScript for WScript shell stuff, right? But when you see basically Word opening up WScript, it's questionable already. Just Microsoft Word opening up any interactive scripting type languages or scripting languages in general, or interpreters, sorry. Those are always worth looking into as weird behaviors. They also, you know, the task kill. They do a lot of task kill based stuff. And, you know, a lot of it's kind of targeting, you know, certain processes that are kind of normal processes, but that's not usually how they're terminated, I would say. But titling a window, right, and then using task kill where you can actually use the window title to kill a specific task based on that criteria is very unique. I mean, gives them a ton of control as far as to make sure that they're killing what they want to kill. But that is definitely not a common behavior from any application I've ever seen. So a huge indicator of like their tradecraft, I would say. Obviously, you talked about the headless MS Edge stuff. Anything headless. There's a lot of browsers you can run in headless mode. Especially with like info stealers and things, I feel like are commonly run that way as well in some instances. So you should already kind of be on the lookout for that kind of stuff. Gosh, I felt like there was something else that kind of triggered me as I was looking at stuff that made sense to pay attention to. But yeah, there was some docm file like extensions, right? And they were like copied, so like they were something then and then something was copied. You know, docm specifically, those files are built to have macros, right? I believe, I forgot what it stands for, but I'm pretty sure that's like very macro specific. So if you're just looking at file creations, just knowing those are there, then you know there could be macros involved, just from a file creation standpoint and naming convention, it's worth noting, or if you have telemetry, you know, paying attention to some of those things. But yeah, I mean, looking at the URL stuff at the bottom, it looks like that little GUID key does seem to change based on their some of their telemetry they captured. So I'm guessing they use it as a tracker as well, right? Because if you're embedding in the XML in a document, it's not being generated on the fly. So they're probably using that at a more granular level than just knowing you opened a document because they have that kind of good key there. But yeah, I mean, like it's, like you said, it's interesting to kind of follow the process and see kind of where they started and where they end up and how APTs kind of operate. They use similar techniques and behaviors that you see across the board, but sometimes they use them in very unique ways. And I would say that's, I would say the biggest standout, like, yeah, they use command prompt, but then they're killing their window with, you know, a title. Versus other people use it and they don't kill things that way, right? So it's like understanding that can really make your hunting or even detection engineering more reliable and potentially be able to affiliate it with, you know, some attribution stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Adding to the, you know, reckless speculation, because there's no, the article isn't saying this, but I also wonder, alongside of the kind of objective is, and I think there's kind of a common energy around APT groups tend to be heavy in the ability to focus on specific targets. And I wonder too, if some of the variants that they hold are both in ways to negate or to adjust around specific defenses, but also maybe curated to go after, you know, specific things that they're trying to accomplish based on given intelligence of the target, right?
Yeah. And if you have multiple targets, like, that's the hardest part about APT attacks, is they are very targeted. They're usually not like the, oh, let's see who we can hit today and make money off them, like ransomware kind of does in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times you don't see a lot of reporting, right? Unless you have a big firm that gets called in and they're, you know, allowed to do reporting, but not, you know, do any of the, like, identify the victim kind of things. Like, sometimes you don't even hear about that. So they're not really worried about their IOCs or other things going out there. But when they've got multiple targets they want to hit relatively in the same quarter time window, whatever, you're right. It would make sense to have different variants so that if one gets smart, they can't, like, post something, you know, in some sort of like UA cert, for instance. And then everyone's aware of it. And now they burned all of their stuff versus just some of their stuff, you know? So.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it also, like, articles like this, and I love reading the intel on APT group personally, because it's cool to kind of see the underlying knowledge of systems, if that makes sense. Like, most of the adversaries, depending on what they are, whether it's APT or, you know, ransomware group or whatever, they generally have a pretty sophisticated understanding of the environments, but APT groups seem to put that together in really wild ways a lot of times. You know, like a couple things that stand out is the way that they went after using MS Edge and, you know, killing it and then starting it in the various modes to make it work. And then the one way that they would start it is to just resize it so small you couldn't see it, it was hidden. Basic small things like that where they stitch in their processes. It's like they understand the systems really well. So it's just like, yeah, goes to a place where that's how we can be the best defenders, understand these systems as well as we can.
I always say, like, when people ask about threat hunting, like, what are some of the skills? I'm like, understanding how operating systems work. You know, I know that, like, sounds like a huge endeavor, but I feel like I understand a lot about operating systems, and it's not because I was like, all right, I'm gonna get like a Windows manual and read through it. I actually just studied adversaries that are exploiting these operating systems and then learned why they were doing these specific things, and that this knowledge grew. And then you can start, like, to have a bigger and better understanding when you can kind of, like, stitch all those little things you learned in various places together to get even a bigger picture. It's probably how I learned a lot of the stuff. So it's almost like, yeah, knowing operating systems, but really learning how adversaries are using operating systems is probably a better way for me to explain that. All right,
Scott, what's the last this week?
We got a lot of meaty ones. So the last one, it's from Point Wild. It is dubbed, let me get to the title here, Remcos Revisited: Inside the Rat's Evolving Command and Control Techniques. So Point Wild basically put out another kind of write up, and I think they even have a reference in there where they talk about previous versions of Remcos, right? So they probably is more deep. I didn't go that route to look at, like, what was old and then added what was new. I just kind of focused specifically on this. But if you really probably want to get a full summary, that the other article, based on how this was one was written, is probably good too, to kind of create the full view there. But they basically talk about some of the key features, right? The Remcos RAT is like your traditional RAT, you know, it gives you remote control, some surveillance things with, like, key logging, screen capture, webcam, microphone stuff. Persistence uses a lot of, like, registry modifications and startup tricks. You know, typical C2, it's got to communicate back somehow. And then it says in recent campaigns, it's actually been injecting its code directly into memory, So trying to use that to help bypass some of the EDR tools, kind of like your fileless attack. And one of the newer things that it now leverages, right, is the ability to capture live video streams. So they can kind of monitor targets remotely. That was like one of the big things. And then the new variant establishes direct online command and control. So, and with, you know, real-time access. So I believe when I was even playing, because Rimsco's, I believe you can get a, you know, rudimentary copy off GitHub. Like it's like an open source rat in a way. And I believe I was playing with it in the past and, you know, you kind of schedule check-ins and then when it checks in, then you can kind of like have it like try to open up a shell. But it sounds like this newer version is more just like live. So you can kind of interact when you want, which also creates a lot of chatter. So we'll talk about that too. But and their infection workflow they talked about was typical phishing email attachments that gets executed and then kind of runs the agent. But one of the unique things that Rimcoast does is it often uses dynamic API resolution. It's a really cool stealthy evasion technique. Instead of hard coding all the names of the Windows API functions, it resolves them at runtime. So the APIs are actually decrypted so that any static detections looking for specific Windows API, like for instance, when you want to inject into a, like a suspended process and then go into its memory to load, like there's specific API keywords or function calls that tools can look for in code. So by doing this, you can avoid some of that. Also makes it hard to reverse engineer when things are dynamically resolved. So, you know, that's like an interesting caveat for some sophistication, right? And then it kind of goes through some of like the key capabilities, the credential theft, keystroke logging, capture, real-time data exfiltration. This one was, I thought, really interesting. It's changed. So I guess previously for the key logging, it used to write to like a local file and then either fetch that from time to time, or I don't know what the interval was, but that's how it gets your keystrokes. This one doesn't live to the C2. So as keystrokes are being hit, they're being sent off and there's no local data store of that. It said it's for reducing forensic artifacts, but I also feel like this is going to increase a lot of noise if you've got a keylogger enabled, right? Because you're just going to be sending ping, 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 and someone's typing certain things, which would look very bursty. And from a telemetry perspective, if everything's going to the same, and if it's going to like a website, that's not how website traffic typically looks, right? It fetches a page, then someone sits on a page, it fetches another page. So it's not this constantly hit the page routine. So that was something to look for. And we talked about this, I think it was the Muddy Water, right? With the geolocation stuff. Well, Rimcoast as well, one of the things that it does includes geolocation capability, where in this case, it actually makes calls to the geoplugin.net. So like another kind of geolocation verification domain to pay attention to, right? If you're looking for what's calling out and determining these things, because adversaries kind of like to know where they're at, you know, in some cases. You know, they did make a call as well that there is a, this variant, they said it created a log file at the program data directory, you know, in the color directory, but it's called logs.dat. If I remember correctly, even the older one, you can enable where it would create logs, but it was like a checkbox when you created the agent that you're going to deploy. So I don't know if it does that by default. Good to note, but I wouldn't necessarily rely on that because I think you can not have it create a log at all. But they talk about that to some degree. The persistence piece. And I was thinking about this and I thought this was interesting, is they actually add a key into the basically the current user software registry directory. And then it's called RMC-GSE-GIF, whatever. The name's not so important. But the fact that it's writing a key there, typically, if you look at even just the things listed, it's a lot of programs that are installed there or installed locally. There's references to there. So it's probably associated with maybe some configurations for those programs that that user specifically is using. But if something is not in, say, it's not in your program files directory, it probably isn't making edits to there, or from a system directory, it's probably not making edits to there. So looking for registry writes from things or programs or applications that are executing from a directory that's not your traditional program file directories or system directories would probably be an interesting tell. I haven't tested that, but that's kind of from the top of my head, just from experience. I would think that would make sense. So it's something to kind of pay attention to. And then the cleanup, you know, this was also interesting. There's references, they didn't call it out specifically, but you can see in some of the cleanup and some of the, like where they pull strings out of the code, where they are using the run key for policies explorer run for a persistence piece. I think I even saw something for registry run key at one point. I know the old one definitely used registry run key, the older variants. So it might still be one of those capabilities. But then how it does is cleanup too. And the cleanup, you know, it kind of sucks to sit there and focus on cleanup, because that's not where you really want to be. Because at this point, if they're doing cleanup, they're either worried about getting caught or they already got what they want, especially with a rat. But sometimes it's good to know that it was present, and maybe you can run it backwards to figure out how they got in and then protect yourself moving forward, essentially. But they create like a temporary Visual Basic script with a random name, but it usually drops in your temporary environment variable directory, which is used to then basically run a WScript shell. So you've got VBS running WScripts that's going to create, basically delete itself that way. And then it's going to create a WScript shell out of that to run command prompt. That will then turn around and delete that W or that VBS script. So like it kind of has two different deletions, but we've talked about interactive script interpreters executing each other, you know, like PowerShell, WScript, command prompt. And in this case, it's at the tail end of this, unfortunately, but still using those types of techniques to achieve execution and success. They're using WScript to basically execute command prompt. So hopefully you at least find that, which, you know, sometimes that's the goal of threat hunting. You know that you're already kind of compromised or breached, or, you know, you're looking for post exploitation behavior. That would be an example of that, right? To be able to walk it back and see what tools may have missed to better improve your security based on your findings. So it's just kind of an interesting technical write up on some of the new capabilities of Rimcoast RAT. I think some of the new capabilities make it potentially, depending on your telemetry, easier to identify, but some of the old tricks that we already look for from a threat hunting perspective still, I think, would identify its presence in some ways. So, just kind of staying up on the up and up, looking at different variants is interesting to see how what direction things are going, because sometimes those things trend, right? If you see a variant that uses a new technique that it's seemed to be successful, other tools, some or other malwares or tools incorporate a lot of those techniques. So that's why they're worth noting. So yeah, what do you think with some of the write-up?
There's a lot here. I'm just going to kind of jump to one piece. So as to not repeat a lot of stuff you said, the, when I see articles, variants, you see, you know, heavy hitter malwares or actors or things like that. And we see, you know, they're evolving and using new techniques. Here's these things that are happening. I always find this, and I don't know if this is going to sound wrong or not, but I always find a sense of comfort when I see the common behavior show up again, right? Like,
right.
They did is persistence. They talk about kind of the, like a bit of the more novel adaptation to their processes. You talked about like the registry key for software, but underlying within it, like they show that it does set the basic current version run key, right? Which is so common, but it's just this, there's almost a sense of comfort knowing that these anchored behaviors are still there, right? So it's like you kind of, it gives that sense as a defender that you can stand up against this threat. You get what I'm saying? Yeah. It was cool to see that.
You know, I think it's when people get really concerned, they're really focused on the, we need to stop all things, right? And sometimes that is like boiling the ocean. That's almost too hard. But yeah, knowing that you can identify key things gives you just the edge you need. I mean, ransomware changed the game based on how quickly they might basically impact your environment, and the impact can be great fairly quickly because it can be machine speed once it gets to a certain point. But if you have, if you're looking for a lot of key things, a lot of the initial breach stuff and post exploitation to get to that point is easily identifiable if you're looking for those common things. That it really just comes to how quickly, once you identify things, can you react as a better countermeasure than trying to prevent everything, you know?
Yeah. And so the counter side of that, I mean, the other side of that, the defenders also have the ability of machine speed. It's just applying that thought process to it properly, right? Leveraging automation for a specific giving behavior that's detected or identified to make an impact decision to isolate a machine is a really soft example, right?
Yeah.
There's ways to combat that machine speed, even with a ransomware piece, although some are a lot faster than others. Some stall based on, you know, where things are. But yeah, just knowing that you can combat these, when you see articles that talk about, you know, newer techniques, things that you might not have considered or might not know how to defend, you can kind of anchor yourself in those common behaviors to know that you stand a chance. You're going to be able to defend. You're going to be able to at least give yourself a shot at mitigating before it's too bad. And that's good. I like saying that.
Yeah. And I like that it doesn't mean you have to like specialize on one type of attacker or one threat. You can apply your skills to many things, which makes you a good cybersecurity person, right? It's like, you know, if you only specialize at one, how much value would you really be? So
cool.
Well, I think that concludes kind of our long-winded but very deep and detailed conversation. So I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 23rd, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.